Okay, so welcome to another podcast, Pill Droid, episode number 62. My name is Russell, and I'm joined by Skype by
Leon. Good evening.
Evening, you okay?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, okay. Bearing up under the circumstances. And in Cardiff with me, we've got.
Hey, it's Rich here.
Where are you on the grief curve?
I've accepted it, but like we were just saying off air, it's not really going to hit me until the World Cup starts, and then I think I'm going to go through it all again. Probably plummet to depths. I didn't even reach even after the game.
I've got the Kubler-Ross change curve in front of me, and it starts off with shock. Yeah, a state of shock, surprise. Then you go into denial, disbelief, looking for evidence that isn't true. Which I think in terms of the Ireland game is blaming them for targeting Joe Allen, which I don't think actually by myself personally, but it was unfortunate that he was filling in this in that particular sandwich. Followed by frustration, recognition that things are different. You sometimes get angry, and then we hit depression, which I think was probably about Thursday. That was me. Thursday was not a good day at all for me with this.
Do you know what? Actually, Russ, I was disappointed, and I'm still disappointed, but I wasn't in any way devastated like I was in 1993 after the Romania game. I didn't watch football for about 3 years after that match. I was so heartbroken. I just decided I couldn't sort of deal with football anymore. I mean, I was 15. I was like a sensitive teenager at the time. But even after the Russia game in 2003, I basically grunted for about a month. That's all I sort of communicated. For a good few weeks afterwards, I was that cut up by it. But the next day after Ireland, I was like, you know what, we'll always have France now. We've been there, we've proved we can qualify. Go again next time.
Well, yeah, I definitely agree with that, because I think on the sort of prior occasions that I guess you, well, me the same as you remember, like 93 and then for the Euros, the playoffs against Russia, they weren't built on anything all that solid, I guess, as it turned out in both cases. Whereas this time, I think there's like the team isn't, it's not the end for this team, definitely. I mean, there's going to be hopefully some development of it, but kind of all the key superstars are going to get better. Like, there's no one who's going to kind of, I mean, okay, you could say maybe Ashley Williams, but I mean, aside from the actual sort of out and out stars of the team are on the rise, and we've got more players coming through. So there's no reason to think, okay, we've missed this one, it's never going to happen again. I mean,
judging by Everton's game against Lyon the other night, he's still got a lot to get out of his system, I sense. Ashley Williams.
Yeah, I mean, that's good. And he should do that by carrying on with us. I mean, there's nothing's been said about him quitting. I really hope he doesn't. I hope he like kind of tries to fight for every single possible extra game he can get.
Yeah. My view on it is he came into the big money in football relatively late, and I would imagine he'd want to maximise that, and that's been my gut feeling for a long time. But I embraced the disappointment like the return of an old friend I hadn't seen for a while. Gave it a crutch, took it out on the piss, listened to some old music you'd listen to get yourself out of a low mood, and then waved it on its way. And I've no doubt we'll be catching up again in, you know, a few years' time at some point. But I'm okay with it now, actually.
Yeah, I think that Barry Horn's put out this brilliant tweet the next day saying, is a little shout out to all the youngsters suffering their first Welsh football heartbreak. Something like, you'll remember this hurt and it will mean all the more when we do qualify again, or something like that. And it's part of the journey, isn't it? Just a few months after, you know, seeing Wales for the first time, I kind of had my heart broken in the Scotland game at Ninian Park with the 1-1. It's kind of part of a journey. And it's like Rich says, with this team, there's more to come. And in 93, it was what was so disappointing, so heartbreaking, was that it for Ian Rush, Mark Hughes, Neville Southall, that generation. And in 2003, it was just, you kind of felt like, that was it for Giggs and Pembridge, Melville, that generation of players. Whereas, yeah, with this team, it's possibly really only Ashley Williams who doesn't have a chance of playing in a World Cup in 4 years' time, I would say.
And of course, in 93, we had the added thing of the FAW just sort of shooting itself in the foot with how it handled the whole kind of Yoroth episode as well, you know, with the contract. So No, I agree. I mean, Phil Stenson said something similar. He said, you know, this is different to 77, it's different to 85, it's different to 93, it's different to 03, and so on. No, and I agree with you both in that respect. It is a lot different, isn't it? I know some people are still hurting, and that's fine. That's fine. Everybody deals with these things differently and in their own personal and private way, is what my therapist keeps telling me. So, okay, we've got a little bit of housekeeping, a couple of plugs to make. But what we thought we would do is, you know, rather than just analyse the Georgia and particularly the Ireland games, because everything that could possibly be said about those has been said, and work had sort of got in the way between the game and now before getting around the mic to ponder these things. So what I thought we'd do is kind of reflect on the campaign as a whole, which will obviously touch on those final couple of games and particularly the Ireland game. But what we thought we'd do is just kind of look at the campaign, reflect on it, not sort of game by game necessarily, but look at some of the key moments, those pivotal moments, and maybe assess where we are and try to do that in a sort of a sober way, because I thought we were going to win that night. Richie was saying four wins from those last four games would take us through. We had all the various permutations. My head was hurting. I'm kind of relieved that we don't have to keep going on about all the permutations in the other groups and which matches we're going to have to play out the way that we needed them to. So that's how we're going to do this. But just a little bit of housekeeping, because since that game, it was only a couple of days after it, Leon, on the 12th of October, we had 40th anniversary of that 77 game at Anfield against Scotland, which was also Brian Flynn's birthday.
Yeah, it was his 22nd birthday in 1977. That was a pretty shit birthday party, yeah. As we said.
It was my birthday, the day we lost to home to Russia in the playoffs. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was a pretty grim birthday as well. And, of course, you've got this book about Brian Flynn coming out anytime soon. It's available to pre-order from the St David's Press website. And so we marked the kind of the anniversary of Anfield, Flynn's birthday.
Yeah,
trying to do the maths now. That means he turned 62, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, you know, excuse for another plug. Get another one in there. Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting as well. It was just a few days after not qualifying for a World Cup to look back on a time when we didn't qualify for another World Cup. yeah. But we're kind of seriously cheated out of it. Well, it's like an incredible sort of iconic and depressing moment in Welsh football history, really. The Joe Jordan handball, which led to the penalty with 12 minutes left. If you look back at that game and you look to the Ireland game just gone, we can't really have too many complaints. They kind of, I didn't like the way Ireland played, but they didn't cheat us out of it. Scotland did in 77. Ireland knew their limitations and they did what they could to try and beat a more talented team, and fair play, you know, they did that. It wasn't pretty, but they found a way to win, so they're not complaining.
No, absolutely. And to be honest, the fans I spoke to pretty much recognise that. If the boot was on the other foot, we would take it all day long.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I think the thing is, if you can't beat Ireland at home to qualify for the playoffs, you don't deserve to be in the playoffs. If they beat you, I mean, that's even worse. That wasn't a great moment for Coleman, that game against Ireland. I mean, it was bad. It was pretty dire. And I would say much of that responsibility lies with Coleman. I mean, he would probably say that. I'm sure he would, because he's like a very honest person. But yeah, if you can't beat Ireland, if you lose to Ireland, you've got no place challenging for playoffs and World Cups.
It's not just that, though, Rich. We played 180 minutes against Ireland and didn't score a goal. And I'm struggling to even remember any chances we created, like clear-cut chances. I mean, we had, you know, there was the Robson Kanu header, which forced a good save. In Cardiff, there was Bale came close to a long-range shot in Dublin. That's about it. Over the course of 180 minutes against a really limited side, you have to say. That was one of the major problems of the campaign. I mean, lots of people talked about all the draws, but to not score a goal in 180 minutes against Ireland is something where Coleman should be looking at himself a little bit.
It just seemed to me, that game just seemed to me, the home game of those two, just seemed to be really similar to the Northern Ireland game in the Euros. And it was just banks of sort of four and five. We couldn't break them down, defending deep. I mean, Northern Ireland at least had Bale to have to contend with. You can understand why you're going to defend deep against him. and he was just crying out for us to just get round the back of them, and we just couldn't do it. And that's what worked in Paris eventually in that game. And as soon as Bale did that, puts in a dangerous cross, and you know they score the own goal. We just couldn't turn them. We got maybe once or twice. Gunter got to the byline a couple of times. Woodburn did, but they just flooded the defence. And I don't know. I just wonder whether we, our decision making under pressure, just seemed to crumble a little bit. You know, there were two key moments in both those games. I don't disagree with the overall analysis, but I think it's a little bit maybe oversimplistic to just tot up the minutes and tot up the goals. That game hinges on Taylor going off in Dublin when we're just beginning to move through the gears. And I stand by it. And I know it's one of those kind of cliched things you say, but I only saw one winner in that game up until that point. And then we just have to hold on. And then you take the draw under the circumstances. And then it hinges on Alan going off, in Cardiff. Because up to that point, I mean, the possession stats must have been something like, 85 to 15% or something. I mean, they barely got a touch, and we were just moving around at ease. Not dangerously, not incisively, admittedly, but we were just probing at them. I just thought, this will come. And as soon as he goes off, it just upsets the tempo, the rhythm, the pattern, everything. And then we took about half an hour just to find it again, I thought. Mm. So I think it hinges on those two key moments. Therefore, other sides will look at that potentially and see a brittleness there. And there's teams out there, of course there are, who will then target Alan, get him off the pitch, and then you're really going to sort of limit then the potential danger that we pose.
We had Fellaini targeted Alan,
yeah,
quite deliberately and quite obviously. I do think Ireland did target Alan, absolutely. I think they targeted a few of our players. And again, I mean, I'm all for doing whatever's necessary to win. I think, Russ, you were saying you weren't sure if they did target him. Their manager is Martin O'Neill and their assistant is Roy Keane. These are people who, in their careers as players and managers, have specifically set out to injure people. That's fine. I just think it's incredibly naive of us, of Coleman, of Roberts, of the players, not to see this coming. And you act accordingly. You prepare for it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's no use kind of getting worked up about tackles when your best player is concussed. I mean, that's too late. I mean, you do it straight away. I mean, there's different approaches you can take to that. That's been whichever one works, that's fine. But, I mean, I think that was a huge failing of, mentality. I mean, we knew they were going to do that. That's what they based their entire game on. So, I mean, you can say it's like a failure to, do due diligence or whatever, or it's kind of a lack of mentality, I'm not sure, but that was weak. I don't think Ireland could have done that for 90 minutes.
No.
And then, of course, Alan running the game, Ramsey was having a really great game until Alan went off. Ramsey was kind of really working space. I think Ramsey was having one of those kind of, you could see it building up to Ramsey either making an assist or getting in on goal, shooting and making something happen. Well, yeah, I noticed that there was a lot of kind of stuff on Twitter, that kind of stuff about Ramsey wasn't great in that game. I think he was doing really, really well. He was on course to have a great game. And again, it's in hindsight, isn't it? It was the wrong switch when Alan went off to drop Ramsey deeper. And again, I'm not sure how you could not anticipate what would happen. Like, Ramsey, I think, is a fantastic player. I think he's a 10. He's not a guy for 8. Or he's not a guy for the middle. Particularly, he's not a guy for the middle against a team that will kick you and elbow you.
So we talked about this before the Austria-Moldova games, about where we want him. And there were some suggestions about him playing deep, because he'd played deep for Arsenal in a couple of games and had played okay. But surely the lesson learned from the Euros is you want him at that kind of sort of at the tip of the triangle in midfield. And that does depend to a certain extent his effectiveness, who's then sitting behind him. Ledley and Alan is the ideal. Obviously, Ledley's had his club issues and the rest of that. But I thought any suggestion that we should choose to play him there a bit deeper, I just think is foolhardy. But I can understand in the context of the game perhaps why he did it. And I'm not sure that he actually played in Alan's role. I think actually Johnny Esther came a little bit deeper on occasions and picked up. So I read it more a little bit more rotational. But then I haven't watched the game back, and you get caught up in the moment to such an extent. You know, we were hurting them and controlling the tempo and everything until he went off. We make the change and we just lost all rhythm and everything, which then lets them off the hook.
Mm. Like, in terms of the mentality thing, Rich, in a practical sense, what do you think Coleman should have done before the start of that game? Or would you have picked a different team or a different formation?
What I was alluding to with that was, if you know the players are going to come and kick you and elbow you and rotationally foul, well, the second they come near you, you go down from minute one, and it stops them doing that. Like, Ireland aren't a great team. They've had one or two decent results, but generally speaking, better teams are going to beat them. And you just stamp that authority. If you can't compete with someone physically, which Joe Allen can't do, and if he kind of faces that treatment, I mean, the best players in the world will just go down. They'll just buy a foul. And if you can accumulate six fouls against Ireland within the first 5 or 10 minutes, they're going to start getting yellow cards very early, and then that will naturally stop them using those tactics. And I mean, you go down quickly, you can pressure the ref sooner. It was way too late to start pressuring the ref once your player's gone off concussed. I think you should make it difficult for the ref, and you make it difficult for Ireland to foul you. We didn't do that. And I think Coleman can say that to the players. I think he can say to the players, it's okay to do that. He can say, I actively want you to do that. People have won World Cups by using those tactics. So, I mean, I'm not sure why we wouldn't.
We've got to get the World Cups first.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I think the key for me is 10 games, and only three of them did we have Alan Ramsey and Bale on the pitch at the same time. That's been cited as a problem in the past. The supporting cast is more able these days than in previous campaigns. But they're still quite... And I think this is where I think you're onto something in terms of mentality. I think that they're still young, they're still callow in some respects. And yes, they will sometimes make an explosive impact like Woodburn did against Austria, but expect them to come on and start controlling a game and changing games, I think is a little bit too much to expect. That, however, kind of is contradicted by the old, I suppose, if they're good enough, they're young enough cliche.
Well,
I think when
Woodburn came on against Austria, I mean, he'd have been looking and Bale was on the pitch, and that's like huge. Against Ireland, I think it was just incredibly painful the longer the game went on. Bale is like physically and ability-wise is just a colossus, like an absolute giant of that team. He's like a better modern-day John Charles. I mean, he's just an absolute monster. Players look to him and he inspires and drives the team forward. He wasn't there and we look completely clueless. I mean, things you could try and say, well, we'll try and win free kicks. There wasn't a guy like Bale there to take him. I just think they missed that figurehead. I mean, and I completely agree. It was a blow. We didn't have those three on the pitch, Bale, Alan and Ramsey, for more minutes. However, that being said, we did win three of the last four games. But possibly that fourth game was just the game where we did need Bale. People were saying, oh yeah, our best performances of the group were away in Serbia and Georgia. Yeah, that's it. When Bale wasn't there. I mean, it's ludicrous. That's a coincidence. That's not because Bale wasn't there. That's just a coincidence.
But that Georgia game, for me, we absolutely controlled.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. They had a couple of little... They had one header. There was that one that ricocheted a little bit and just kind of fell helpfully into De Hennessy's hands towards the end. I thought completely in control of that. And that was the game that a lot of us were more worried about of the two. I mean, people have kind of written off the campaign as a failure, and it is a failure in the sense that we're going into that out of pot one, where the top seeds in that group, and to finish third, I think, therefore, you can conclude nothing other than it is a failure. We're European Championship semi-finalists, we don't get to the following tournament. But I think, actually, places and opposition that we've struggled against in the past, we have taken a couple of steps forward. So, I mean, you did the blog about, you know, before the Georgia game, Lyon around Tbilisi. I mean, you know, we've had absolute hidings over there. And we controlled that game from beginning to end. And I think that was a step forward for us. Serbia, I thought we looked composed. Serbia grew into the game, admittedly, and you would take a draw. We probably needed better to take the heat off those last four games, but you would sort of take a draw before that campaign started. But I think that's more a reflection of how we're set up. We've been better away from home for a while now. I think sides just know they're just banks of four, banks of five, and we're going to struggle to break them down. Which then when we talk about Alan and Bale and Ramsey and the creativity they've got, again, you know, is it right to cite their absence as a problem when we've got them and yet we still struggle to put some of those stubborn, defensive, organised sides away?
I just think, overall, I don't think we're a good enough side to go 10 qualifying games without losing one. In this campaign, the one that we lost was the last one. What cost us quite clearly was draws, especially to have taken the lead, I think, five times over the course of those four games that we drew. That's where it went wrong. It's not the Ireland game It's basically not seeing it out. So, I mean, you know, talking about breaking teams down being a problem, but we took the lead in, like I said, in four of the five games that we drew, we took the lead. We took the lead twice in Vienna. And it was just sloppy play, just not the right mentality at certain times when we should have been going for a two-goal lead. We never had a two-goal lead at any point in the campaign, bar the first game against Moldova. I mean, I said it at a time after the game in Vienna. We were 2-1 up at half-time, away from home against, you know, a rival for a top-two place in the group. The Austrian team came back out early, geeing each other up. They looked really psyched up for it, pumped up for it, and we kind of trudged back onto the field. And I just thought, you know, we've got to be looking to, when we're on top, we're doing well, we're leading, we've got to look to kind of bury teams. And yeah, to have taken the lead so many times and let the lead slip was more a problem for me, I think, than this idea of not being able to break teams down.
I think you're right about the Vienna game. We did, we trudged out. The attitude wasn't quite right, and it wasn't right then for then the game at home a few days after against Georgia either. From that point on, I thought attitude wise we were fine. I think we approached it great. I mean, maybe it was the internal camp messages that, you know, Coleman, Ian Mitchell have emphasised, and some of the people that have written about Wales in the last couple of years have emphasised the importance of how, you know, the press conferences reinforce internal messages to the players within the camp. Maybe that was something, I don't know, but I think you're right. We did trudge back on, and Austria really kind of pumped, and what was within about 2 or 3 minutes.
Just some sloppy passing from us and Anotovic is through. It felt like about 2 minutes into the second half.
Yeah,
that was a key moment. And then Alan went off in that game as well. And it wasn't so much the fact that he went off in that game that was a problem. It was more that we had Georgia at home a few days later, and we were already without Ramsey, and then to be without Alan as well meant we didn't have a technically good enough midfield against Georgia to win that game, I don't think. Even though we took the lead and we started off quite well, people said, oh, we were complacent and sloppy. I just don't think we had good enough players out on the field without Ramsey and Allen. So that was a big blow as well. But to not see it out against Serbia at home, that was the big turning point of the campaign, I think. For me, it was that 5-minute spell. Bale hits the post. They go up the other end. And Mitrovic, just the header just kind of just like creeps in, doesn't it? Comes off Hennessy. I was in the pub watching that game, and I kind of let out this kind of sort of like mangled yelp of like no. So, you know, because it just felt like that was the moment, the turning point, and it was going to be so hard after drawing that game at home to Serbia, when it looked like we were going to beat them for the first time. We were really playing catch up then. So those were key moments of the campaign, I think.
I don't feel words adequately describe the anguish of that yelp. You have to try and recreate it, I think.
I can't,
you
know,
just try to conjure the moment.
I'm trying to give you a little example. I can't kind of find it inside. Just, I couldn't do it justice.
Try and fess up for a moment, yeah. You try to conjure it up, and Rich, you say something for a couple of minutes while he's trying.
All right, yeah.
But it was the key thing, wasn't it? It was the key thing, and what really annoyed, if you watch the game back, I mean, I don't know, do people tape games anymore? Because I haven't found it on YouTube. I've just seen the cross for the goal. It's an identical cross, goes to go in, and Chester is grappling with Mitrovic, and the cross, I can't remember the circumstances, whether the cross gets blocked or what. And he kind of gets back across him, and there's a bit of a tumble or something. And then the one goes in, and Mitrovic just, I mean, he's a big boy, to be fair. And we looked pretty strong all night, I thought, defensively. And he just manages to just get kind of away from Chester for a split second. And I thought Hennessy should have done better. I thought he should have done better for the goal out there as well, actually. And he just flaps at it. For me, that was pivotal. And we're having an iron as to whether we're allowed to use the term sort of fine margins in this or not, right? But for me, that is one. I mean, it is just clearly, definitively is one. Because it's a point swing as well. I didn't think much of Serbia in that game, to be perfectly honest. They got better, I think, as the campaign went on. And they grew into the game out in Belgrade, obviously, as I said. But I didn't think much of them at all. And at that point, I thought they were probably, I know Ireland had started off well. I thought, if we're going to do anything in this campaign, they're probably our rivals. Having taken points off Austria in Vienna, and Austria starting slowly, probably if you can cite, and if there's any merit in citing one key pivotal moment of the whole campaign, which kind of maybe is a bit of an oversimplification of it all, then I think it's that. whatever it is, 30, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, something like that. There's a great picture. I think it's Andrew Dowling. He took a picture in the ground on the night, and he's kind of behind the post that Bale hits. And it's a perfect picture because you've got Bale, you've got the covering defender, and you've got the goalkeeper just beating all ends up, just looking behind, thinking, oh, shit, this is it. And, of course, it just bundles away. And I think I'm all right in saying as well that, is it Ramsey that is not that far away from getting the rebound? I'm pretty sure there was somebody following up that wasn't that far off.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah. But that happens to lots of countries and lots of games. So maybe it's picking it up too much, I don't know.
Yeah. I know Gaz particularly doesn't like the phrase fine margins, but that game particularly was a game of fine margins, and it was pivotal.
For Gaz, he thinks fine margins is basically a metaphor for just being average, which I think is fair. But I think that catalogue of moments there is the very epitome of it. And the margins are small at this level of the game anyway, because of the talent, because of the pressure, because of the circumstances and everything. So I think that, you know, that's just kind of how it goes. And they go for you, they don't go for you. Northern Irish fans will probably argue the same in Paris. Bale clears one off the line out in Brussels in qualifying at the last campaign, you know, right at the very end. I think there's lots of fine margins in that previous campaign that seemed to go for us. Maybe in this campaign they didn't. But again, maybe that's just, you know, using luck as a, in this sort of cliched, hackneyed way. Ray Vahean, you know, he has no track for this stuff. You know, you prepare for these things, and using luck as an excuse is just that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone seriously... I mean, I do agree there were fine margins all throughout the group. And I mean, brilliant teams have fine margins that make them the brilliant teams that they are. But I think I agree completely in terms of what Leon was saying about losing the lead. And again, I think, and I'll qualify this by saying, I'm not definitely saying I'm someone who doesn't think Chris Coleman should carry on necessarily, but I do think, look, like the best teams in the world lose leads, but we've lost a lot of leads. And then as well as losing the lead, we've not been able to get the lead back. So that's two failures there. And I think that comes from the manager, I think, in part. Because like you were saying, Russ, the manager sets the agenda in terms of like attitude and focus and that kind of stuff. And also, I mean, one of the big advantages of Coleman is, or was, that the players love him, and that's fantastic. But like you, I think as a player, you'd probably also want to be slightly fearful of what'll happen if you screw up. And I'm not quite sure if that would be the case with Coleman so much. I mean, they're kind of really desperate for him to stay. And that, again, that shows they like him and it shows they play for him. But I don't entirely think that's a great thing for players to feel that comfortable with a manager. I mean, in terms of you might, like, even if it's a subconscious thing, I'm not sure whether you respond so well to someone in a high-pressure situation if they're your best friend.
And I think it was really clear how quickly reports of them as players asking him to carry on came out, you know, even before that day is out, if memory serves me correctly. No, you know, that's great to a certain extent, but I agree with you that is that a reflection of it being too cosy? Is it a reflection of it becoming too familiar?
Well, I mean, yeah, you can look at it, and Aaron Ramsey is a guy who's delighted to be playing for a club manager where there's no pressure to perform, really. He can just kind of cruise on, and he seems perfectly happy with that, and he hasn't asked to move. And I mean, and it's not an exact comparison with the national team, but I think it's just interesting to me. And I think sometimes it's good to sort of know what the players think and how they feel, but ultimately I think it's about getting results, and the decision shouldn't be made exclusively on whether Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey like Chris Coleman.
And then, of course, you know, Leicester fire their manager, and you know that headline or those reports write themselves, don't they, really?
He would have no chance of getting that job.
Okay.
No chance, no.
Really?
Yeah, no. No chance. Well, based on like kind of reports, they're looking for big-name, successful managers. Chris Coleman isn't that. I mean, he's not. Even if he did get that job, he would be realistic enough to realise that's a 4 or 5 month job. That's a job until the end of the season, or maybe 3 weeks into the next season, if he does okay with them. It wouldn't be shocking if Chris Coleman got appointed next week, it wouldn't be that much of a shock if he was fired in February, if he didn't immediately turn them around. I mean, and that would be fair enough, I think. I don't particularly subscribe to the idea that managers have to be given 3 years to build a team. I mean, you go in there and you make it happen straight away, I think. But I mean, from his point of view, I don't think that would be a great move, and I don't think he'd have a chance of getting that job. I don't see why they would appoint him. I mean, I think he's got a great achievement at qualifying and he's got a fantastic achievement in the Euros. He's got a massive black mark on his record now. I think his stock has gone down massively, and correctly so, I think. It's not like it was a failure in the second leg of a playoff where some freak incident happens or, you know, Bale gets injured in the first minute. It's not that. We didn't qualify for the playoffs in an average group. And that's very, very bad for his record. So I'm not sure precisely who would want him.
I thought that's an unfair analysis.
But what I would also say, just to kind of add on to that, I hope that doesn't influence the FAW into saying he'll be easier to keep now, so let's just keep him. I really, really would want them to do a proper, like, full-on analysis and decision. It's not just his decision if he stays on. It's not just for him to say, I want to stay, and they give him a new contract. I think they have to decide whether he's the best person to carry on. And I'm not saying he's not either. I want that thought about and discussed.
Yeah.
Just that idea of, like, assessment. I don't know. But I don't think that's something they really the FAW go in for, and something I mentioned a while back, I think on the Apostle message board, that I would like to see something like that come in, where you have a panel and you have people, ex players or people who are involved in Welsh football, kind of just look, interview the manager and just assess, well, you know, what happened in this campaign, where did it go wrong. How are we going to put it right next time? I don't think there's any sort of internal process like that at the FAW, which is a shame, because, you know, it would be really good to hear actually Coleman sort of go through a process like that and come out of it and say, look, you know, I know I got some things wrong in this campaign, but it makes me extra determined to put it right next time round. And I think that this idea, he has got a black mark against his name now, yes, for not qualifying for this World Cup. But if he looks ahead to the next campaign, the Euros is 24 teams. Third place is going to be good enough for a playoff. So even if he messes up a bit, there's more leeway in qualifying for the European Championships. And it's a chance for him to sort of redeem himself in a way. So, you know, I'd hope that maybe Coleman, if he does want to stay on, if his heart is in it, is thinking, I can do this next time. There's good young players coming through and there's more places up for grabs and we'll have a good seeding. And it hopefully is extra determined to do better next time.
I do think we would qualify under Coleman. I think he could do the job. Like you're saying, it's easier. There's more leeway to qualify. But I still think you need to then discuss whether he's the best person who would do the job to maximise what we could do. Because, I mean, to me, the Euros is a tournament to target to win it. Absolutely. Or kind of to get to the semi-finals, to get to the final. And then, is he the person to do that? Perhaps because he got us to a semi-final previously, but then he's failed at this stage for the World Cup, which is harder to qualify for. But it's not for me to say. It's for people to work out. It's for him to sort of be honest with himself. I mean, I can't believe that Oshan isn't feeding back to the bosses what he thinks went wrong. And not out of, like, a lack of loyalty to Coleman, but, I mean, part of his role there is to kind of oversee stuff. So, I mean, he'll have his thoughts on where it went wrong.
Which is why I don't see him as a candidate to replace Coleman.
Actually, yeah, no, absolutely.
Because
not, no.
If you're working on the basis then that there is a vacancy then, that Coleman will go at the end of the contract, at the end of November, to put Oshan into that just creates almost like several vacancies, because he has input at so many different age grades. He's the architect of a lot of the, you know, the coach education stuff, which is, you know, hugely regarded, you know, not just in Wales, but, you know, across Britain, across the UK, you know, on the continent as well. So that's just a non-starter, which might be unfair. I mean, you know, you can almost make yourself too indispensable in the role you are. And I have no idea if he has those sorts of aspirations. But I think that's also a bearing on whether Coleman stays. It's not as simple as whether he stays or goes and who then comes and replaces him. It's what happens to the whole structure and the setup and the pathway that's in place. And I would hope that the FAW will say, no, whoever we approach or whoever approaches us recognises that they have to work within this broader environment, and that actually is, I'll say, it's more important than the head coach, because clearly that's a key appointment, but that you can erode the foundations and go back to a situation that we had, for example, when Hughes was in charge, where everything beneath the senior team, senior men's team, doesn't really matter. And that's just no good for us as a country because we're too small. We have too small. I've never really bought this thing about us having a small population as being a problem. Our professional playing base is too small and too narrow. So we have to do everything we can to keep kind of broadening that and deepening that. And I would imagine there are probably some out there, some, you know, top headline coaches for whom that therefore rules them out. And on paper, they're considerably more, you know, qualified and able than Coleman. But the job has to be available with all of those conditions related to the whole structure and setup beneath and around it.
I think it's like a very, very specific kind of head coach we can go for in terms of like kind of achievement profile, age profile, like salary profile. I mean, look, like top managers earn upwards of like 3 or 4 million a year. And Coleman's on 300,000, wasn't he? So
very few international jobs pay big money.
No, but the point being, if you could earn a couple of million for 6 months at a club, plus £1 million for keeping them up or whatever, Tony Pulis, I'm not sure whether like that's going to be that appealing to come and managers for like rewards that are not financial, that are more spiritual. I'm not sure Tony Pulis has got a soul. He's like this is a guy who thrives on non-relegation bonuses, just rotating around all the clubs. And then, he would be a complete non-starter, wouldn't he? But there's a couple of really obvious people who would come into the frame. But I mean,
does Ryan Giggs have a soul?
I think he does.
You think he does?
Yeah, I think he does. But I think it's a very tortured one. But I do think he has one. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe that's how he can have lasted so long. He was like Ferguson's chosen one. It was because he knew there was no kind of moral compass or anything. It was just, he would just follow orders without asking any questions. But there's a couple of guys. And like a really interesting thing that became apparent to me was previously when we've looked ahead and we've like spoken about managers and stuff, like I'd always been of the impression that Craig Bellamy was not the most popular guy in the squad, particularly with the younger players, because they felt him kind of to be over aggressive and kind of really difficult, which he is. But what has become apparent is, yes, that was true with some of the younger players, but the players who really like him and are basically some of his best friends in football, who call him to discuss moves to clubs and stuff, are the core group of players now. Kind of basically correcting myself from 2 years ago, or like 18 months ago, when Coleman was kind of in trouble. They would love Craig Bellamy to be in charge, with like kind of Ramsey, Bale, Allen. They're kind of very, very close to him.
I think Bellamy's far more likely than Giggs. I just think Bellamy has just a little bit more about him, personality and character-wise. And yes, it's flawed, but nothing else. You really genuinely get the sense that he cares. He cares, I mean, possibly too much when he was playing, and he just speaks his mind. Now, whether that works when you're a manager, I don't know.
But the thing is, I don't think you need a manager for 4 years or 8 years. I think you need a manager for one qualifying campaign. Because we've got the system in place, got a manager for one qualifying campaign and one tournament, and you award contracts per tournament, basically. Mm-hmm. Like the thing, really interesting thing about comparing Giggs and Bellamy is, Bellamy is working for Cardiff in the youth. He's doing the training, he's doing that job. You'd have to wonder why Ryan Giggs isn't the manager of Wales under-16s. Why isn't he part of our coaching setup on some level? Why isn't he working with us? He's going for jobs and failing at interviews. Mm. You'd think he's got the time, and if he had the interest, he would be becoming part of our setup. And I know that Bellamy, that's something he wants to do. So
yeah,
for me, Bellamy can't turn around and say, I'm bringing my three trusted assistants from my 30-year managerial career. Mm-hmm. He will just come in by himself. And he would also, because he was, his playing profile is like a small, fast player that fits the kind of player we have. And that doesn't necessarily translate to success, but it shows he would be of that sensitivity to that style of play, that style of player. Everything I've heard about what he's doing at Cardiff is based on like fast counter-attacking style of play, and also kind of action style as well, which is when we're at our best, I think. I previously had doubts, but that was based on a wrong assumption of who the players who didn't like him was. But the core play, Basel players do really like him, and they're very close. They're probably still terrified of him, but
But that's good. I think that's what you want, isn't
it? Yeah,
I remember Frank Lampard giving an interview a while back, and he was asked what do players want from their manager, and I think his answer was tough love. That's it, and I think they'd get tough love from someone like Bellamy for sure.
It would be interesting, wouldn't it? Mm. I mean, you know, going forward, so he gets the job, whether it's now, whether it's in the future, you know, it would be interesting. The press conferences would be interesting. The post-match press conferences would be interesting. The antics on the touchline would be brilliant. So I think there's an agreement. You know, it is a failure given how we started as pot one, and okay, whether it's fine margins or that's just the euphemism for averageness or whatever. But there has been some good developments along the way. So if you look at us looking forward, there has been Woodburn coming into the squad and making an instant impact, and he really does look a talent. Tom Lawrence towards the end, I think, has taken a couple of steps forward that we actually, before that last doubleheader, we were kind of just really hoping he finally would. You weren't particularly kind to him, were you, Leon?
Can I just take this opportunity to apologise to Tom Lawrence if he did listen to that podcast? He was excellent against Georgia. I thought he was absolutely superb, not just a goal, but like a few minutes in, just that run and pass to Ramsey. Maybe Ramsey should have hit the target. That's what I wanted to see from him. He's got it in him to beat a man. He's got pace. He's got a good shot on him. I wanted to see him take players on and shoot, and he did that against Georgia, and I thought he was absolutely superb. And I would like to offer an unreserved apology to him.
I'll edit the apology out. It was just tough love. We've concluded what they need, these players. That's what that was. Yeah?
Yeah, I should be the next Wales manager.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck it.
just think what Craig Bellamy might have called him to get him G'd up, you know? So I thought it was great, and I thought what was interesting, and again, it goes to prove how important the whole preparation is, which stands to reason. Of course it is. That's why it's preparation. It's why they do it. But it's not just who they play, personnel, formations, tactics, etc. You could sense in the week running up to that game that they were really kind of investing in Lawrence, because he went out for press conference duties. And with all due respect, he's not an orator. There's far better players at doing that. But it was clearly a way of sort of saying, Tom, you are really important to us. And he presumably knew he was going to start, because I think he is, you know, we've said this before, he is the closest player to a Bale that we've got, in playing style-wise. That was key, I thought. I thought it was a real indicator. Now, whether that was part of it, I don't know. Send him off for all the press conference if that's how he's going to play off the back of it. He has stepped up. What's the other positive things? Let's end on a positive.
Ben Davis was excellent through the campaign, and he's still only 24, I think. I think he's really stepped up into a sort of leadership role through this campaign. He's been a regular player for a while, but perhaps he wasn't being talked about during the last campaign and during the Euros so much. But now, I wonder if, you know, if Ashley Williams does go, if he might move across to play centre-back in a two alongside Chester, perhaps. Because we have more options at full-back than at centre-back, that's for sure. But having said that, Ampadu, you know, I haven't seen anything of him other than highlights of his Chelsea debut. But he can play centre back as well, can't he? And I think Ashley Williams has said that he's kind of sees him as his natural replacement eventually. Well, to be 17 and to have actually made as much progress as he has, that's very promising, because he looks a real player as well.
Mm. Well, he was on the bench for Chelsea this weekend,
right?
Which is good progress.
Yeah.
Ben Davis is like an elite level player, or becoming one in his position, I think. So like, it's just about whether that's at left back or centre back. I mean, what I'd really want to see is a situation where we're playing him in the position where we get the most out of him, I think. So whether if that's kind of been a really kind of classy centre back, or whether it's more beneficial, because Chris Gunter isn't a good attacking fullback. Ben Davis has got a great cross and he's got a good shot. So he's a real kind of asset, like attacking. So I would, on balance, probably, because we haven't got a brilliant fullback at left back other than him, I would probably rather keep him there.
Yeah, but I think Neil Taylor is being written off a bit prematurely by people. I think he's coming back into form at Villa, but they've really picked up, haven't they? It wouldn't surprise me if they get back into the Premier League next season. I don't know, people talk about Taylor as if like he's past it and he's still only 28 or so. I accept that probably Ben Davis, well, yeah, I accept Ben Davis is a better player, but I think Neil Taylor has had a, apart from this campaign really, I think he's had a really good Wales career and gets a lot of quite unfair criticism.
He's going to be sweating over that many future caps though if Davis is staying at left back in a flat back four. You just can't pick Taylor over Davis. You just can't. The way he's playing at the minute, Davis. I thought probably pound for pound, I thought he was probably our best player over the course of the campaign. He played more than Alan for a start. I mean, when Alan played, he was imperious. But on the basis that he missed too many games, I thought Davis was our best player. And I still think Chester is, you know, he made that one mistake for the Mitrovic goal in Cardiff. But I still think he's solid. I still potentially think he could almost... Well, I suppose Ampadu probably will overtake him. Ampadu probably, you know, if all the reports are correct, has that class. But for a while, I thought that actually it wouldn't be a case of who's going to replace Williams, that almost Chester replaces Williams in the sense of the role that Williams plays. Starting attacks, feeding the ball to Allen, taking the ball off Hennessy, you know, getting it all going again. And actually what we're looking for is a centre-back to then complement Chester. And in defence, partnerships are key. You know, James Collins has played far much more Premier League football than those two put together, but you wouldn't pick him over Chester and Williams ever. And I think, you know, they work well as that combination, so I think that's key. That's the worry I've got. In terms of everyone sort of talking about the talent coming through, the cupboard looks bare at centre-back until or unless we start playing some other centre-backs and they start getting some game time that we can actually see what they can do. So whether it's Lockyer or Walsh or Ampadu or moving Gunter across or Davis across or whatever it is, until we start seeing that, which is why I think we need to see something happen in these next two friendlies.
I think goalkeeper as well is
and absolutely, and you look at it as a unit as well, and I think it's time. You know, we know exactly what Hennessy can do. I'd probably give him maybe a 7 for the campaign, 6.5, 7.
I think he's a 6 out of 10 player, which is not to kind of say he's a bad player. I just think I can't think of many times Hennessy is saved us. He's not kind of, he hasn't got that kind of special quality to him. He's made a few mistakes along the way. He's never been consistently bad. He's never kind of been a liability for us, but I don't think he's a very good keeper. I mean, that's not to say any of the replacements are better than him, but I think you've got to look at them and give them a chance, even if that's a case of just tuning Hennessy up mentally a little bit.
I mentioned it before, I think in a previous podcast, that he's been sort of undisputed number one for a decade now, and it's really about time we saw another keeper put some pressure on him. And it's quite a disappointing thing, Danny Ward's situation at the moment at club level, considering he's had two really good loan spells with Aberdeen and Huddersfield, where he made a real impact. So he seems to be third choice keeper behind two absolutely terrible keepers at Liverpool. They lost 4-1 today, didn't they? Didn't Mignolet have another nightmare? The club's not going to play him, loan him out. I think Huddersfield wanted him for the season, you know, give him a chance to play in the Premier League. But I'd really like to see Danny Ward put some pressure on Hennessy now. And you know, I like Hennessy, but it's about time we saw someone else emerge and try and really grapple that number one jersey off him.
Well, this is for me relates back to kind of the discussion about Coleman and whether a fresh face comes in, because for a start, a new manager coming in, let's just say it was Craig Bellamy. I mean, this is probably true of any manager. The new manager comes in, unless you are like Bale or Allen or Ramsey or Davis, now you're thinking, well, okay, I need to impress this guy. I'm not starting as number one choice in my position necessarily. I'm going to have to fight for it. I think Hennessy would be one of those players. And also, I think Coleman, kind of through his inherent conservatism, is someone who rarely takes chances with selection, and I think probably he would think of it as a chance to change goalkeepers. So it would be interesting to me, if Coleman did stay, whether he would look at goalkeeper and think, this is an area where I'm going to have to freshen it up a little bit. Because I think the thing is, even if, say, if you're looking at Danny Ward come in, even if Danny Ward isn't better than Hennessy, well, he's different, and I think that can have positive effects as well. And Hennessy also was sub for Crystal Palace at the weekend. He was out for one game and he didn't get his place back. And yeah, okay, he was out for the game where they beat Chelsea,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah.
But still, if you're the number one, you automatically come back in for that 48-year-old Italian guy who played against Chelsea, irrespective of how good he was. Clearly, Hodgson is looking at that and thinking, well, this guy isn't necessarily the out-and-out number one.
Argentinian, but with an Italian name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah. Speroni.
Yeah, Speroni. Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay, I didn't know that. But
It doesn't change the point of the argument. I'm just a pedant like that. Any other talking points to the campaign? We exhausted it. We distilled it all.
I do wonder about the limitations of Sam Vokes and how Robson Kanu, who are very good players, but they're not top strikers. I mean, it's not like we really have one banging on the door or anything, but there's perhaps another way to go up front with the emergence of Woodburn. Maybe Bale could play through the middle, or I don't know, you could go for a kind of more of a fluid front three in this kind of style that Liverpool kind of have at the moment, where they don't really have an out and out centre forward, do they? Maybe that's something that Coleman or whoever is manager for the next campaign should be looking at as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can definitely say that, like, a forward line of Bale, Woodburn and Brooks. I mean, that sounds incredible. Well, I was going to say, I guess it's just kind of down to what happens if Bale isn't playing. But, I mean, Bale normally, I mean, this campaign maybe not so much, but normally has got, like, a brilliant attempt, like, appearance record for us. So, I mean, yeah, I would probably agree with you. I mean, I think Vokes and Robson Kanu, both of them that. I mean, Vokes, I think, is going to have a bit of a struggle at Burnley now. They've signed Wood, who's done really well and is clearly their number one striker now. And Hal doesn't really have a club career. He's almost like a guy who plays for us and then trains with his club team, but he's not a serious prospect for them. So yeah, that does make it difficult, I think. And probably, Leon, I agree with you, what I was saying. It's kind of about working out a way of changing how we look at forward play, and whether Chris Coleman's the guy to do that, I don't know. He might be. And you would think, going on this, again, someone like Craig Bellamy, someone with newer ideas, schooled in a different way, played under better managers, he perhaps might be the person who have thoughts and opinions on that, that are kind of refreshing. And again, it's that kind of thing. I don't think a new manager has to be better necessarily. I think they just have to be as good as, and then different, and give a new voice, a new impetus, and kind of kickstart what we're doing.
It's a bit predictable, isn't it, at the minute, up front?
Yeah.
It's easy to defend against, isn't it? You know, you look, coaches must be looking at them kind of going, whether it's him or it's him, they're not identical players, but whichever one it is, it's easy to contain that threat. Now, key thing previous has been having other threats, and those particularly, I think more so Vokes being that pivot for other players to pick up knockdowns and things like that. I just wonder, I mean, I don't think, you know, he's not the answer to the problems, but I just think it gives our attacks maybe some other focus. Would be someone like Bradshaw, because he's, and it could well be that Woodburn can do this as well, playing as a striker. But neither Vokes or Robson Kanu make runs behind the centre-back. They don't make runs between the centre-back pairing, you know, in the way that, you know, classic sort of strikers that we've had in the past, like Saunders and Rush, obviously. I mean, you know, what would we do for another Rush? We're looking to turn centre-backs, looking to just create that doubt. We don't work centre-backs anywhere near enough, those two. Robson Kanu a little bit more so, and Vokes can kind of bully them a little bit and put himself about. And they'll forever be heroes, of course. It's no reflection on that kind of overall sort of status, because they were, again, you know, we'll always have France and they will always be part of that. But a different striker, just to give our attacks a little bit of different shape and different focus. I want to see things change, or to be tried at the very least in these two friendlies, because I think they're really, really good friendlies. Fair play to the FAW. Coleman has complained in the past about how the top nations tend to just divvy the friendlies up against among themselves. So it's great that we've got like a champagne friendly against top opposition, you know, one of Europe's great cities. It's easy to get to for the fans. I think it's going to serve as a real good kind of palate cleanser for what's just happened. And then to come back then and get a home friendly against different exotic opposition, their tails are going to be up because they've qualified for their first ever World Cup. Some of their players have got like 120, 140 caps or something ridiculous. And I was looking on Wiki, they've already played some like 20 or 21 internationals this year. It's only October. So they're probably going to know each other, be well-drilled. But then they've also got to try to do something to keep that momentum up. So they're going to want to, you know, there's no point them having got to World Cup, first game, coming to us and playing, you know, two banks of five. You know, so I think they're really two potentially really attractive friendlies. Well, no potentially about it. They are attractive friendlies. So all credit to the FAW. But I want to see us try some things. And equally, there's no point going to France and just trying to stay compact and play on the break. They're going to have more of the ball than us. That's fine. But let's try and do something, because I think we haven't evolved tactically enough. Personnel-wise, it's just coming in. When we were doing this before the end of sort of last season, so before or after the Derby game, I forget, the away game, it was still the same players in the squad, pretty much. It was still the same substitutions being made. Mm. Vokes for Carney, Carney for Vokes, Edwards, King.
Well, yeah, and that was like the really disappointing thing against Ireland. Just the straight swap up front, because it was so evident that Ireland were finding it incredibly easy. Mm. And you've got Brooks on the bench. Coleman has said he's good enough to play. That's why he's here. They wouldn't have known what to expect from him. He could have created a moment. He could have won a penalty. But again, it's Coleman's kind of natural conservative approach to the game. Stuff like that's worrying. At what point is he going to say, look, we can't really use Vokes and Hal as this dream team one-on-one-off? I don't think managers change in their careers, because there's the... You work out what's good and you stick to that. And please, people, tell me, like, who are like managers who have changed. I'm struggling to imagine him changing his approach, like in game. I mean, you can talk about kind of preparation and tactics at the start, but he's not a great alterer of games, particularly with timing wise and stuff like that. So yeah, that would be really interesting to see what if he's there, what he would do from that point onwards. And starting off with those friendlies, which are great, which are good games, I agree. They're really good. Mm. Probably not going to be a sellout, but I would really hope... Well, okay, look, it's going to be... The people who were there before are all going to be still there, and I think it's going to be quite raucous, and I think it'll be fun anyway. So I'd hope for an upbeat atmosphere in downbeat circumstances, I guess.
But Wales is for life. It's not just for the Euros.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
It's not just for friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's wrap it up there. Probably get around the mic again before those friendlies, because I think the squad will be interesting. I think, again, personnel selection issues, I think, are going to be interesting. Experimentation will be good. Experimentation is actually a bit on that grief curve. It's a way in which you've exercised some of those demons that take hold of you. Mm-hmm. So I think, there we go. It's all on the internet. It's all there. The answers are there. How we deal with all this downbeat pessimism and depression. We had a few people. Simon Price was one. We're looking for closure. We're waiting for our podcast until Turk could give them closure. If that's what you're looking for, I hope that's what you've got. If you wanted to continue to wallow in disappointment, then I hope there's something for you in it. If you're over it, then let's look forward. Enjoy France if you're going. That feels like it might be kind of putting something to rest as well from the hangover from the way the Euros ended. But until next time, Dilchavau, thank you very much. And a very quick plug just for our podcast where I went at the Merthyr and I chatted with the Parkview Martyrs, with Holby, with Jamie, to Mark Evans. Thank you to Mark for putting that together. That was a lot of fun. We've had some terrific feedback on that one. And we're going to be doing something similar at the end of the month. I think it's going to be over half term week with Tim and the Fearless in Devotion guys up in Wrexham. So that date has been fixed. Leon, hoping you can join us for that one as well via Skype. And it'd be great to kind of look at what Wales and Wales away and the history of games at the racecourse, which is always a really popular ground, obviously, for both players, and historically down the years, a successful ground as well. Be interesting to kind of look at Wales from a Wrexham perspective.
I'll try and join you for that if possible. That'll be really interesting, I'm sure. Make for a really good podcast.
And the Parkview Martyrs have set the bar high for all these other kind of club and Wales, club and Cymru has a bit more of an alliterative sound to it. The bar has been set high by the Parkview Martyrs one, so I'm really looking forward to that. So yeah, until next time, chins up, people, chins up. Hits always coming.